A week later, Biden declared in his first foreign policy address as president that we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Regarding his practices at the border, Biden administration officials promised a shift away from Trump's practices of separating families and caging children, calling them a moral failing. He said that the new White House would deal with immigration comprehensively, fairly, and humanely. As 2021 comes to a close, however, we are seeing the latter part of the trajectory that settles into familiar, disastrous militarism. The United States is selling Saudi Arabia $650 million worth of missiles and providing $500 million worth of maintenance for U.S.-made aircraft, training, and other support for its military operations. These arrangements come as Saudi Arabia is escalating its devastating bombing in Yemen. In November, Saudi forces carried out the largest number of airstrikes since Trump's last year in office. These bookends Biden's early announcement of an end to U.S. support for the war in Yemen and his subsequent robust material support of that war captured the set of practices that the Biden White House is settling into, not only in Yemen, but also in the realm of war and imperialism more broadly. Consider the White House's approval of a $23 billion weapons sales to the UAE, which provides the Emirates with attack drones and F-35 fighter jets. The arrangement was negotiated under the Trump administration as the prize for the UAE's role in leading the normalization of diplomatic relations between the Zionist regime and itself, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, despite the Zionist regime's deepening violence against Palestinians. The Biden administration embraced the normalization agreements along with Trump's other actions meant to consolidate U.S. support and extend legitimacy to the Zionist regime in a time when Palestinian protest presents a steady challenge to the Israeli apartheid and global Palestine solidarity campaigns have gained more traction than ever. Trump fulfilled long-standing wishes of the Israeli regime right-wing, including moving the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds from Tel Aviv, declaring the legality of the Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian West Bank, which are considered unambiguously illegal according to international law, and endorsing the Zionist regime occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights. Yet, when it comes to concrete action, Biden has accepted and continued along his predecessor's path. This continuity is also painfully evident regarding Biden's actions toward migrants, many of whom have been displaced due to U.S. imperialist policies. For example, in the face of severe social, political, and economic crises in Central America, which are driven by decades of Washington-directed economic policies and brutal repression carried out by U.S. armed regimes in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, Kamala Harris in Guatemala City, on her first overseas tour as vice president, presented the U.S. foreign policy in cruelty do not come. Once they approach or enter the country, migrants face a complex of forces that remains in place to detain, incarcerate, and deport migrants and prevent their entry to the United States. Biden has maintained the use of Title 42 a statute that allows the federal government special powers in public health emergencies to deny migrants, including asylum seekers, access at the U.S.-Mexico border in violation of international law. Biden is thus continuing Trump's use of the measure, which was invoked when the COVID-19 pandemic began. Public health professionals and scholars have argued that the measure cannot be justified in the name of public health and have called upon the administration to end it. Biden has also reopened some of the most notorious detention sites highlighted in the Trump era, including Florida's Homestead Shelter for Unaccompanied Children. The numbers of people in detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, have swelled to 22,000 under Biden, marking a 56% increase since the day the new president took office. Biden's most dramatic and revealing act at the border this year was his handling of the arrival of thousands of primarily Haitian asylum seekers at Del Rio, Texas in September. From border patrol agents on horseback whipping the black migrants to their confinement in squalid conditions on riverbanks and under a bridge, the U.S. government and its police forces engaged in racist violence, treating the Haitians as a criminal threat to its contained rather than vulnerable people with the right to seek refuge and asylum. Biden deported the groups of thousands to Haiti in an operation that revealed the logistical capacity at his disposal, which could, of course, instead be used to welcome people and support their survival. Finally, the Biden administration has resumed Trump's infamous Remain in Mexico policy, which forces people seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border to apply in Mexico and wait there while their applications are processed. The policy goes against the U.S. law, which guarantees people the right to apply for asylum inside the U.S., regardless of how they entered. Biden initially opposed the program, suspending it in February. In the face of rulings by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, however, the White House negotiated a new version of the policy with the Mexican government and has begun to administer it, the program which made tens of thousands of asylum seekers vulnerable to kidnapping, assault, and other hazards in Mexico under Trump is now Biden's. At the moment, Afghanistan faces mass hunger and an economic catastrophe as billions of dollars belonging to the Afghan Central Bank sit in the United States, frozen by order of Biden administration. Yet amid these blatant continuations of state violence, grassroots pressure has clearly made an impact. Biden's rhetorical vows to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen, for example, MTS Day War were responses, in significant part, to a years-long, consistent and vocal challenge of U.S. support for the war.
IRIV English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIV English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazvi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
According to New York Times and several other news outlets, Washington has decided against punishing any members of the U.S. military involved in an August drone attack in the Afghan capital. 10 civilians, including 7 children, were killed in that attack. An internal Pentagon review has concluded that a bombing in Kabul did not violate the laws of war and was not caused by misconduct or criminal negligence. The U.S. military defended the bombing, insisting that it targeted terrorists who intended the attack U.S. soldiers.
August 30th, 2021. Grieving and baffled Afghans gather around a mangled vehicle inside a house in Kabul. An apparent explosion a day earlier had killed 10 fellow civilians, including 7 children. The sorrow and confusion, however, would gradually give way to fury and clarity as media reports and investigations emerged over the following days. Finally, some 20 days after the incident, the U.S. decided to come out with the truth, admitting that it had made a, quote, tragic mistake in targeting the civilians. This came after initially defending their strike as righteous and insisting that it struck a Daesh vehicle carrying explosive to blow up Hamid Karzai International Airport. The strike came in the final days of the U.S.-led evacuation of Kabul after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. There was widespread condemnation of the attack, with Iran saying the U.S. cannot exonerate itself by downplaying such atrocities as mistakes. Yet, as it now turns out, this is exactly what the U.S. has done, with the Pentagon saying that there will be no disciplinary action against any U.S. troops or officials. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin had received a high-level review of the strike that made no recommendation of accountability.
None of their recommendations dealt specifically with issues of accountability. Secretary reviewed their recommendations. I won't get into all of them. Some of them are understandably classified, but he approved their recommendations. So I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the August 29th airstrike.
This has further fueled criticism of the U.S., with the acknowledgement of the mistake standing in stunning contrast to its refusal to hold anyone accountable for any wrongdoing.
This is typical U.S. governance. There's no accountability. These are war crimes. There's no question about that. And yet the U.S., which admitted liability in this and is compensating the victim survivors, is not holding anyone accountable for this crime, the slaughter of 10 people, including several children. This is why the U.S. will not sign the Rome Statute and join the International Criminal Court, because it knows that it commits war crimes around the world. This one is just one of many that this crime has been committed. And the U.S. doesn't want to hold its soldiers accountable in any way, or doesn't want anyone else to hold them accountable.
Sadly, the Kabul drone strike against civilians was not a one-off incident. Just last month, a report revealed that the U.S. military had tried to cover up 2 back-to-back airstrikes against supposed Daesh targets that killed up to 64 women and children in Syria in 2019. In 2 decades of wars across the world, from Afghanistan through Iraq and Syria to Somalia, the U.S. military has killed hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians. And while the military occasionally accepts responsibility for an errant airstrike or a ground raid that harms civilians, rarely does it ever hold specific individuals accountable. Maybe that trend will change one day when the U.S. itself is held accountable by the international community.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guest in this edition. Radio host and journalist Don DeBar joining us out of New York. And from Afghanistan Task Force of Schiller Institute, Carol Varekin out of Paris's suburbs.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let's go to New York. Don, this is Pentagon, and it's not acknowledging, it did not acknowledge this deadly strike until a week after there was this Times Magazine investigation, and there was video evidence challenging assertions by the military that it hit a vehicle carrying explosives meant for the Kabul International Airport. I want to ask you the reason behind this reluctance and reticence, if you will, on the part of the U.S. military, usually in such occasions and incidents?
Well, they're committing war crimes and genocide against thousands of victims, potentially millions of victims, on an ongoing basis for decades. They don't want the world to have a conversation about it, and they don't want the American people to realize that that's what their money is being spent on. And so the only people that are ever punished in these cases are the whistleblowers. For example, Julian Assange. For example, Manning. For example, John Kiriakou, etc. The people who expose these incidents end up being the ones that are prosecuted, and those that are responsible for them, from the President of the United States, who authorizes them, to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then to the military commanders, down to the person sitting in a closet somewhere in upstate New York who thinks they're playing a video game in terms of how much threat they're under, while people are being blown apart on the ground, including seven children in this one of many, many incidents.
All right. Now, Carol, how do you look at this? Do you agree? I'm sharing the same view with Don.
Yes. But I think the point is to look to the chain of command. Armies as such always have difficulties to recognize their errors. But there was a lot of chaos on the ground, but also in Washington itself, among different factions, among the White House and the Pentagon. And some military probably were so frustrated, and they felt something, and they did doing anything. So the result was both incompetent and horrendous, including that the person they was targeted, Zamari Ahmadi, which was suspected to be a terrorist, in reality was a humanitarian worker working for a U.S. charity, trying to distribute water to people which needed it. So the reputation of the U.S. military is definitely at stake here, both internationally but also at home. And if the press hadn't done their job, the affair would probably have been ignored, as many others before.
Mm-hmm. Now, Don, as you know, the Pentagon chief has decided not to punish any U.S. troops for this Kabul attack that killed civilians, and they just suffice to call it a tragic mistake. Is that how human lives matter to Washington?
Well, it's not a mistake, because the very presence of U.S. troops in Afghanistan is a violation of international law. So any death that flows from that, whether justified under U.S. excuses or not, is an individual war crime. See, the problem is not that this one wasn't a terrorist and instead was a civilian. The United States annually, going back to at least 1945, kills more people every year than the entire collection of terrorists on the planet that year. Mm-hmm. Who's the terrorist?
Exactly, good question. Also, there is this bad terrorist and good terrorist. Okay. Now, Carol, the Pentagon says that the Kabul attack did not infringe on laws of war. Laws of war. What laws of war are they talking about? Killing women and children and shirking responsibility? Or is it calling peripheral damage? That's the word they use, you know, that's, it's inevitable in any war.
Well, as you said before, normally, as was said before, normally there was a transition of power has been reflected on since the Doha agreements of February 2020. And some in Washington, they might have thought that this should become a bloodbath, a disaster they could then blame on somebody, on their opponents. So there was confusion on the stage, and which only was multiplying the dangers. Now I think the only way to make, to honestly repair this evil policy would be to immediately release the $9.5 billion of assets of the Afghan Central Bank. We don't need excuses and condolences. You know, we need a policy to rebuild this entire region by mutual win-win cooperation, not by, we can put somebody in jail and we should completely drop this lunatic so-called precision drone strikes, which is completely incompetent.
All right, Don, this seems to be common practice for the U.S., I mean, the way they did it, isn't it? I mean, drones or troops kill people in the course of operations against the shadow enemies like Al-Qaeda or Daesh or ISIS. Civilians are killed, not only in Afghanistan, we have the same cases in Iraq and Syria and Somalia. And the U.S. military, from time to time, they admit to errant strikes, and they rarely ever hold perpetrators accountable. Let's have your thoughts on that.
I mean, the mode that was used in this case publicly after this particular strike was exposed, and you're going to see a prosecution probably if whoever leaked it to the Times or whoever at some point. But the mode that they used tells all. Okay, The people that are involved in the incident, normally, if you're accused of committing murder, in essence, you know, an illegal killing, a felony, under the military code of justice, you're entitled to proceeding with what's called a court member panel, which is like a jury.
Right.
Okay, there's objective fact finders instead of the decision coming down from on high. That, when they said that they would not face trial, that meant that the outcome was not going to have those hands in it. It was going to be decided by a much more powerful and smaller set. So they kicked it into an administrative proceeding, essentially, where the determination is made by the people at the top. So when they decided that that's how it was going to happen, they already decided that either one possibility was they were going to use the operator as a scapegoat instead of holding the people responsible for putting that person at the controls of those weapons which were illegally used to murder someone. And instead they were going to decide, you know, who it would be, but not them. The actual responsibility in the chain of command goes to those at the top who made the policy decisions and then gave the orders to implement them that resulted in these deaths, which occurred by military action not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, which means it is illegal under international and U.S. law. And consequently, someone should be prosecuted for those murders. They decided instead that they would protect everyone involved from an actual legal proceeding that was transparent because they conduct these things over and over, and mostly they never come to light in the media here, and consequently they are able to operate with illegal military action around the world with impunity and in the dark. That is what we are seeing one peak of when we see this particular case.
Right. And Carol, as Don is saying, I mean, you have this top military brass that Don believes that they are the people actually who decide. In this case, in the Afghan case, the top military brass decided that, well, that was a mistake. They apologized, but they are not going to punish any U.S. Military member or serviceman for whatever they did. They simply apologized for it. Okay, now, who should hold these top military brass who decide if they've done anything wrong or that was natural and it happens in any war?
Well, the final tribunal is the conscience of the world population. And what's happening with these, if you go back in history, this is completely a degeneration of military warfare. Because over the last 20 years, the U.S. has privatized military operations. They want less regular army on the ground, boots on the ground. So they put in these private military corporations, which are mercenaries. So part of the drone strikes and the people operating them has been outsourced to private military companies such as Blackwater and other consorts. Now, we know since the 15th century, Machiavelli warned everybody that soldier of fortune, you know, it's the worst thing you can do. So this is completely illegal and opposite to the U.S. Constitution. So we can have international tribunals, but we should especially mobilize the American population to clean up their own country, and because these people should be judged as traitors, including towards the U.S. Constitution, which is completely opposed to what's going on right now.
All right. John, there was also this investigation by the Times that revealed a top secret American strike cell launched tens of thousands of bombs and missiles against Daesh in Syria. But in the process, the commandos sidestepped safeguards and repeatedly killed civilians. And it's Afghanistan, this is Syria now. And again, where's accountability?
Well, start with the fact that, in fact, the U.S. war in Syria is not a U.S. war against Daesh. It's a U.S. war against Syria. And Daesh, in essence, are the ground troops coordinated with the American airstrikes and other military actions. Before the U.S. decided to go, there was no Daesh. Daesh is a creature of the CIA and the U.S. military, and on occasion, you get some daylight into that. Like when Trump decided Daesh is the enemy, they were gone in 2 weeks, and suddenly they come back with Biden. I don't know if he drove them there or what. So if we're looking at what's going on in Syria for some daylight on this whole thing, what's going on in Syria is U.S. impunity. They have decided they don't like the government there. They're going to change it. They've been working on that now for 10 years. There have been millions of people displaced, hundreds of thousands killed. No one is accountable for that. Again, this is a resolution that was voted down affirmatively in the United Nations Security Council several times. And until Daesh came on the scene, there was no enabling political cause for U.S. military action there. Now, military action has been conducted out in the open, more or less, for almost 10 years.
Right. And Carol, speaking of Daesh or ISIS, we also have these U.S. Drone attacks and targeted killings and extrajudicial killings. The instance of which is the Iranian top commander, General Soleimani, who was at the vanguard of the fight against Daesh in Iraq. He helped the Iraqis get rid of Daesh. He was targeted in a U.S. attack. So we also have these extrajudicial killings. We have condemnation from UN rapporteurs and all that. But on the ground, not much changes. And the U.S. is still going on with these drone attacks. Everywhere in the world, they want to target whoever they want to simply take them out.
Yes, the problem is that since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91, some people got the crazy conviction that the United States, with British backing, was the only remaining superpower in the world, and therefore it can do whatever it likes without being accountable for anything. This is the type of arrogance of power which makes it blind to reality and to its own errors, and it's a symptom of its own doom. And the best people in Russia today say, dictate to the U.S. that the U.S. should not make the same error as they did when the Soviet system collapsed, right? Which is the idea of impunity and arrogance of power.
Now, John, as you know, the U.S. does not accord recognition to the International Criminal Court, ICC, nor to the International Court of Justice, ICJ. So which world body should hold Washington accountable for its wrongs.
Well, first I'll add to that, that by the way, when they decide that some party's interest in the world could be adjusted in favor of Washington's or the people that the politicians in Washington work for, then suddenly the International Court of Justice and the ICC are, you know, valid international forum to have those things vetted. For example, the Philippines finding in the ICJ regarding South China Sea and the adverse claims in the area around Nicaragua and Colombia. You know, the United States is hot or cold depending on what the outcome is in these in a different each forum. So you have to consider that they really are playing a game of hypocrisy. But to the answer, where do you go for that? Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, we'll see how it plays out, the only people that can hold the United States government and the powers that control it, because that's really where the enemy is, are the people of the United States and in solidarity with the people of the world. And the task becomes more and more urgent to deal with this every day as the body count climbs, as the scope of the activities increase, and as the arrogance and impunity of the people that are conducting these wars in the first place finds no limit.
Mm-hmm. Carol, what do you think? If not international tribunals, so who can do what to stop this?
Well, people should escape from their video games and their Netflix addictions. You know, people should become real citizens. And it's only because we are creating real citizens in most countries in the world, and especially in the United States, that we will be able to deal with this issue. This is like a cultural war, you know, to return to a real civilization. It's not just a formal political problem. It's an entire paradigm, which is completely rotten. And if we don't change the paradigm, we will not change the outcome, or the type of events we're seeing right now.
Okay, Don, we have one more minute if you have any final comments.
I completely agree with what he just said, and if you need any evidence of that, look at your children or grandchildren, how much time they spend looking at a device that's telling them what's going on in the world instead of looking at and living in the actual material world,
right.
And you'll see where the problem and the solution lies.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. We had a radio host and a journalist, Don Dibar in New York, and from Afghanistan Task Force at the Schiller Institute, Carol Breakin joined us from the suburbs of Paris. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
In the limelight. What happened on 6th of January was an attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election results and the rule of law. That threat is far from over. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Rebecca Solnit. The piece is titled, America Witnessed a Coup Attempt, Now It's Sleepwalking into Another Disaster. Even as the mob ran screaming and smashing through the Capitol on 6th of January, it was clear this was a coup attempt. It was equally clear that it had been instigated by the then president and his circle, much of whose audience in the Stop the Steal rally would become that mob. Everything since has been filled in, important in building the legal case against the leaders of this attempted coup and establishing the facts for history and public knowledge. And one hopes for efforts to prevent another such attempt. That the goal was a coup is a solemnly horrifying fact. That those who orchestrated it and those who have excused and dismissed it afterward continue to conspire against the rule of law and the right of the people to choose their leaders is another such fact. Documents such as the PowerPoint presentation turned over to the 6th of January House Commission by Donald Trump's then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows confirm the details and build our understanding of the threat. On the basis of sometimes ridiculous pretexts, the circle around Donald Trump intended to steal the election and seize power. Many, including Utah Senator Mike Lee and South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, reportedly knew the agenda. Had they succeeded in grabbing power with such an openly lawless act, they could have kept it only by suspending the rule of law. This is what a dictatorship is, and this is what they wanted. A government in which laws are nothing, and the ruling junta or thug is everything. What the American people and foreign nations would have done in response might have overturned it further down the road, had it not failed on that day. But the whole business is still terrifying, and the threat is certainly not over. It was clear the military leadership was already alarmed. On 3rd of January 2021, all 10 living U.S. Secretaries of Defense co-authored an editorial declaring efforts to involve the U.S. armed forces in resolving election disputes would take us into dangerous, unlawful, and unconstitutional territory. Few Republicans would defend the U.S. Constitution, the voice of the voters, and the orderly transition of power was also obvious. At 1:09 p.m. on that day, the Capitol Police Chief said he wanted to declare an emergency and call in the National Guard. At 1:11 p.m., Donald Trump ended his speech with the words, "If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." At 1:12 p.m., two of America's slimiest elected officials, Congressman Paul Gosar and Senator Ted Cruz, were objecting to certifying Arizona's electoral votes. Congressman Paul Gosar, according to two participants in the riot, seemed to know what was coming and had promised blanket pardons. The evacuation of the House and the Senate would begin an hour later. At 2:24, Donald Trump tweeted, "Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution." Two conservative Republicans, Vice President Mike Pence and Congresswoman Liz Cheney, have been among the few to refuse to participate in the coup. and also in the big lie and the surrounding corruption, and have paid for it. That terrible day, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy reportedly called Donald Trump to rage and curse at him and demand he call the mob off. But he would then fall in line and fudge the reality and significance of what had happened. That day, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell noted that to overturn the election results would send democracy into a death spiral. Afterward, Mitch McConnell was furious and shaken, but he too squirmed his way back into alignment with the big lie. By May, he was trying to block the formation of the 6th of January committee to investigate what had happened. The crisis isn't just that we had a coup attempt almost a year ago, but that the Republican Party was itself become so venal, so corrupt, so ruthless in its quest for power that it seems assured that we will see further attempts to overrule any election outcome that they don't like. Already, the kind of election laws they've pushed across the country seem aimed at such goals, and voter suppression has long been one of their anti-democratic tactics. It played a substantial role in Donald Trump's 2016 presidential election win and the genuine illegitimacies of that election. Foreign interference, anomalies, the recount might have uncovered had the Republicans not stopped it, were appropriated as false claims for 2020. The Republicans made a devil's bargain decades ago when they decided that they would not change course to win the votes of an increasingly non-white, increasingly progressive people, but would try to suppress those who would vote against them. That is, they pitted themselves against democracy as participatory government and free and fair elections. The rhetoric of the far right makes it clear that they are fearful and know their power will ebb if they cannot command and subvert the laws and elections of this nation, and they are aiming at some form of minority rule. That's perfectly clear from their attack on the constitutional process unfolding that afternoon of 6th of January, which was itself a refusal to accept an election loss. The refusal to recognize the authority of Congress by Donald Trump associates, including Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows, is further sign of their belief, emboldened by Trump's 4 years of criming in public, that they make their own rules. Both Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows have been found in contempt of Congress. The crisis isn't just that we had a coup attempt and have a political party that has gone rogue, but that much of the rest of the nation seems to be normalizing, or forgetting, or sleepwalking through the crisis. The warnings are getting more urgent. They've decided to burn it all down with us inside, said NBC anchor Brian Williams on Thursday in his parting words before leaving the network. Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii stated on Sunday, "The road to autocracy is paved with overly chill responses from people who would see this all with great clarity if only it were happening in a faraway place." Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy declared, "This is nation-ending stuff we're dealing with here, and folks better wake up soon. I'll do my part. Think about what yours is."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Emmanuel Macron, the French president and the fiery preacher of human rights. In his recent tour of the Persian Gulf, however, he forgot to broach the subject altogether. Instead, Macron brought with him a large delegation of French ministers and top-level business executives to finalize lucrative arms deals with the United Arab Emirates and whitewash Saudi Arabia, two of the worst countries in the world in terms of human rights.
حادث حدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
Macron's visit to the UAE in early December coincided with the country's 50th National Day anniversary and concluded with a controversial weapons deal. The United Arab Emirates and France signed a $19 billion arms deal for 80 Rafale fighter jets and 12 military helicopters. It was the biggest international order ever made for the warplanes. The deal came despite opposition from rights organizations for the prominent role of Abu Dhabi in the bloody Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen. Abu Dhabi has also been embroiled in the Libyan crisis, where it has civilians' blood on its hands. In just one case on November 18, 2019, the UAE launched an awful drone attack on the Al Sumbula biscuit factory in Wadi Al Rabi, Libya, that killed 8 and wounded 27 civilians. After a visit to the United Arab Emirates and a short stop in Qatar, Macron landed in Jeddah to be the first major Western leader visiting the Saudi Crown Prince since the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. In the words of Lina Al-Hafloul, the sister of prominent Saudi women's rights activist Loujain Al-Hafloul, Macron is trying to rehabilitate the man who tortured my sister, killed Khashoggi, cut his body into pieces, and created the worst humanitarian crisis in a neighboring country. But all good. Macron has upcoming elections and needs his deals done. With his visit to the Saudi kingdom, Macron has been accused of putting deals before human rights, but he seems not to be disturbed at all by the accusation.
Actually, they are supporting groups like the Saudis who are killing people in Yemen. So France, like the rest of the West, is using these organizations like Amnesty or Human Rights Watch when it suits them. So when they think, okay, we will tell something, but actually they commit, commit atrocities in the name of human rights, you can say, especially in Yemen now. But the whole of the Middle East, they did, and still do.
During his visit to the Saudi kingdom, the French president underscored the necessity of working for stability in the region, while failing to mention that the road to stability cannot bypass freedom and human rights. He also failed to mention the destabilizing role of France in the region by spurring an arms race through selling weapons to the regional autocratic states. Along with the UK and the US, France has faced scrutiny over its continued arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition. a coalition that has claimed the lives of nearly 4,000 Yemeni children and displaced nearly 700,000 Yemeni families while causing one of the worst humanitarian crises in modern history. All of these crimes never made the French think twice before signing arms deals with the coalition. On December 3rd, the investigative website Disclosed revealed that France authorized deliveries of tens of thousands of arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in 2016, knowing that they could be used in Yemen.
Well, I think it's good that it's finally out in the open, that some people like we know already for a long time that France is involved in the Middle East, actually since 1948 when countries like Lebanon and Syria gained their independence. But they're still mingling around in the Middle East because they are, as we know already, they are sending weapons. It was already known in 2015, I think, that they were sending weapons to Yemen. And we never forget what happened in Syria. They were, I think, one of the key players together with Britain to send weapons to Syria. So they always have this. And of course, also they were quite in North Africa, you know, they had other colonies. So, yeah, it's good that it's out in the open, that maybe the broad public knows now that France is a key player, still a key player in the Middle East, and trying to mingle around there.
Documents obtained by Disclosed show that under François Hollande, the French state authorized the delivery of nearly 150,000 shells to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in the heat of the Yemen war.
They have the idea of getting back to Bonapartism, so they will want to establish their role for themselves in the region. Now the U.S. has facing a lot of problems and is more focused on the AUKUS, on Australia and China, the Chinese South Sea, so they are neglecting the Middle East. And France sees a very big role for itself in the Middle East again, unfortunately. So they sell the weapons most likely also to Saudi Arabia. And hopefully it will not result in another war again, but let's hope for the best.
Disclosed confirmed that Paris sold the Saudi forces 41,500 shells made by Gongas Incorporated, and sold the Emirati Army 3,000 anti-tank shells, 10,000 smoke shells, 50,000 explosive shells, and 50,000 artillery rockets made by Nexter Group. In the context of the Yemen war, France can be viewed as the symbol of Western hypocrisy, preaching the virtues of human rights while in reality putting profits before anything else.